3 days after the Wisconsin Supreme Court decided not to take up a case challenging the legality of using drop boxes for ballots during an election, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WIL, filed its own suit on behalf of two voters asking our courts to do the same. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And this suit would reportedly not only end the use of ballot drop boxes, but would also prohibit voters from allowing anyone else to return an absentee ballot, their absentee ballot. So what do you want to know about your right to vote in Wisconsin? Do you find our elections to be safe and fair? And what about the problems this lawsuit might solve? And do you see as any potential consequences or side effects of this latest legal action from WIL? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to join our conversation. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is the President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, Rick Essenberg. Rick, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
As mentioned, this lawsuit from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty came 3 days after the Wisconsin State Supreme Court decided not to take up the FABIC case about ballot drop boxes. Why did you file this suit? Was it in response to the Supreme Court's lack of action?
Well, I think this issue needs to be resolved. This issue first arose immediately after the 2020 election, when it was raised by the Trump campaign. It was raised as a number of issues that they brought before the courts, and they claimed that Wisconsin municipal clerks had not followed the law with respect to how absentee ballots are to be delivered. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court refused to resolve that claim. They invoked what is called the doctrine of latches, and they said, "Look, if you had a problem with what the clerks were doing, you should have brought that case prior to the election. For us to determine whether these votes were lawful after the election, when the clerks thought they were, would be fundamentally unfair." And I have a great deal of sympathy for that provision. These questions should be resolved in the odd numbered years. We shouldn't be trying to get clarification for voters during the middle of an election or in the immediate aftermath of an election. So we brought this case to have this issue resolved prior to the voting so that municipal clerks and voters would know what is permitted and what is not permitted.
And Rick, what specifically is the issue that this lawsuit seeks to resolve?
Well, the issue is this. In Wisconsin, we all have a right to vote. The legislature has long made clear that it will allow for absentee voting, but that absentee voting is not a right, it's a privilege, and that the processes that must be followed in order for absentee voting to take place must be rigorously followed. And it's not hard to imagine the reason for that. When we have absentee voting, we take the voting process outside of the supervision of municipal officials. So it's important for us to have safeguards in place so that we can be sure that absentee ballots will be counted. We can be sure that there won't be any wrongdoing taking place. And one of the things that the legislature has done is it has said that there are two ways to return a ballot. One is that you may place the ballot in the United States mail. The legislature has decided it believes the United States mail is sufficiently secure to permit this to be a way by which absentee ballots are returned. Or you can return it to the office of the municipal clerk. That is, the voter himself, and it says the voter, returns the ballot to the municipal clerk. That way, having this process of returning the ballot come under the supervision of municipal officials. It does not provide for handing the ballot to somebody else and having that somebody else return the ballot to the municipal clerk. It does not provide for drop boxes. And so the question is, is that reading the law correct? And I think it is. And the question is, are we going to follow that law in the way that we conduct our election? Now, the issue in the case is not whether you like drop boxes, not whether you like what is sometimes called ballot harvesting. It has nothing to do with this case. If these are things that you like, then your recourse is to go to the legislature and have them provide for those things. But if they are not provided for in the law, then they may not take place.
Rick Essenberg is our guest, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. And if you have questions, our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. So is there, under your lawsuit, if affirmed, Rick, is there any way that a ballot box could be used correctly for an election by a municipality?
No, I don't think so. There is a provision in the law for the legislature to designate an alternate site other than the clerk's office. To be used instead, not in addition, but instead for the receipt of ballots. But again, this would have to be staffed by the municipal clerk or their authorized representatives. A drop box is not staffed. It cannot be, you know, designated as a person to receive ballots. So, no, I don't think that it could be used. I think if we want to have drop boxes, if we think that's a reasonable thing to do, then the recourse is to have the legislature provide for drop boxes. And if the legislature did that, presumably it would do it in a way that ensured the use of drop boxes was even-handed, right? Because one of the concerns that people had with drop boxes is that there were a lot of them in densely populated areas where municipal governments, you know, have a lot of different facilities. And so there are many more places for drop boxes to be placed, and that this disadvantaged rural communities. And the second problem is security, right? Should the drop box be unsupervised? What are the procedures for receiving and logging in ballots from the drop box? None of that was specified in the law because drop boxes are not allowed for in the law. And so if we went back and we had the legislature enact the provision for drop boxes, as has happened in some states which have passed election reform bills, including those that are, you know, generally attacked by folks as being, you know, exercises in voter suppression. Well, you know, oftentimes what they're doing is that they are providing for drop boxes when drop boxes had not been provided for in the past and had simply been used without authorization in the law during the 2020 election, as they were in Wisconsin.
Let's go to the phones here. Jason in Watertown, you're on the Ideas Network with the President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, Rick Essenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I have to say I'm a little confused about the question of drop boxes, as in you say that it's legal and all that to drop a ballot in the mail. Well, mailboxes are not guarded. Mailboxes aren't watched. What's wrong with the drop boxes? It would be the same thing, wouldn't it?
Rick, Jason raises a point that my mailbox probably is no more is much less secure than a ballot drop box.
Well, again, that would be a great argument for Jason to make to the Wisconsin legislature if he wanted the Wisconsin legislature to authorize drop boxes. But the problem that Jason has is that the Wisconsin legislature doesn't agree with him. The Wisconsin legislature, and this isn't recent. This has been in the law for a long time. The Wisconsin legislature has said, no, we don't believe that. We believe that you either return the ballot to the municipal clerk or you place it in the United States mail. And I think that the reason that the legislature said that with respect to the United States mail is the Postal Service has a long record of maintaining security within the mail. I mean, it has figured out pretty well how to keep mailboxes secure. It has figured out pretty well how to make sure that things get to where they're going. Now, that may be a wrong judgment by the legislature, right? The legislature may be being too restrictive. It may be being too permissive in allowing you to return a ballot by mail, and that's a debate we can have.
But you're saying this is action that the legislature should take, but this is now in...
When we're talking about cases in court, but the question is not, we don't go to the judge and we say, gee, what do we think, how do we think we should handle this? That's not how judges look at this. Judges must look at this by saying, look, what does the law provide for? If the law provides for drop boxes, then we can have drop boxes, even if that particular judge thinks it's a bad idea, and if it really is a bad idea.
Rick, hold there, please. That's the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Their latest lawsuit is seeking to end the use of ballot drop boxes in Wisconsin elections, as well as allowing others to return an absentee ballot on your behalf. What do you think of this latest legal action at 1-800-642-1234? We'll continue with Rick Essenberg and your calls. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our guest has filed suit asking for clarification from our legislature. And while our legislature may not be clear on the way we've legislation may not be clear on the way we vote, the attorneys for our legislators may have a little more definition. Before last year's election, attorneys for Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and then Republican State Senate Majority Leader, now Congressman Scott Fitzgerald, sent a letter to Madison City Clerk explaining why they believe the city's Democracy in the Park events were illegal. Part of their argument explicitly acknowledged and accepted ballot drop boxes as a viable and legal alternative. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest says that state law is clear. There are only two legal methods for casting an absentee ballot, and drop boxes fail to meet either definition. Will this lawsuit pave the way for a better democracy? If so, tell us how. And if not, please explain. 1-800-642-1234 is our phone number. Our guest is the president and general counsel at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WIL, Rick Essenberg. And Rick, 500 drop boxes were used in this, across the state in the 2020 election. Is there evidence that these ballots returned via the drop boxes were counted or not counted, tampered in any way? Do you have any suspicions about the 2020 election?
Well, let me clarify something. We haven't asked the legislature to do anything. We're asking the courts to make sure that municipal clerks follow the law in 2022. If someone else wants to go to the legislature and ask them to provide for drop boxes, they can do that. We don't have a particular position on that at this time. With respect to the 2020 election, there would be no way to know if there was any particular concern about drop boxes because municipalities were wildly inconsistent with how they treated drop boxes. Sometimes they kept records of what ballots were collected from drop boxes, and sometimes they didn't. And so, you know, the way that you would attempt to identify a potential problem, wouldn't prove a problem, but it would be a potential problem if you had some type of anomalous spike in votes, or if you were able to look at the ballots that were put in drop boxes and determine if, whether or not there was some reason to be suspicious of where they came from. But we can't do that because municipal clerks did not consistently distinguish between, you know, ballots that were returned in what we believe is a legal way and ballots that returned to drop boxes. A Democracy in the Park is a perfect example of that. My recollection is that I think Speaker Voss or the Republican Party, I can't remember who, asked the city of Madison to keep those ballots separate so we would know what ballots came from Democracy in the Park so that we could look and we could see if they were just fine or whether there was a problem there. But the city of Madison declined to do that. They intermixed those ballots with everything else, so nobody can really evaluate the situation. You know, the problem is not, and I have not claimed, and I don't claim, that, you know, the 2020 election was stolen or there was, any particular level of fraud in the 2020 election. What I am saying is that it makes sense for us to have a system which has proper safeguards in place, and whatever we think those safeguards should be and whatever we think those rules should be, it is important for us to follow the law, because that's the only way that we can have elections in which people have confidence in the outcome. If we make it up as we go along, if we change the law, we do things that aren't provided for in the law, even if they're good ideas, even if we think at the time they're good ideas, you know, they will sometimes be perceived as having a partisan impact, and confidence in the election are will be undercut. An election is contest. There are two sides in an election, and one of the ways that you make you get two sides to accept the outcome is you follow the rules that have been agreed upon beforehand.
But as I understand it, Rick, the municipal clerks across the state have said this was a safe and secure vote. They didn't find any irregularities or spikes or anything that would be anomalous.
Again, as I said, there's no way to do it because the records weren't kept. But again, in terms of this lawsuit, that doesn't really matter. What matters is whether we followed the law. If we want to change the law, there's a process by which we do that. And I know that this is an antiquated notion nowadays, where people feel that, you know, we should elect a president, whether he be Donald Trump or whether he be Joe Biden, and that president just should, or a governor, and that president or governor just should be able to change the law however they want and however we think it might be okay to do that. Well, that's not how our system works.
Let's take a phone call here, Rick, if we can. Let's go to Carolyn in Madison. You're on with Rick Eisenberg, the president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Good morning.
Hello. A vote is counted by no matter where the ballot comes from. It's got to match the signature and address of the voter. And a poll worker was telling me that there should be no challenges to the voting system unless the person challenging volunteers to be part of an election, volunteers at the polls for, just to see how well they police that simple measure, no matter where the ballot comes from.
Carolyn, thank you. Other reaction here this morning, Rick, in response to the lawsuit, Disability Rights Wisconsin told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel they support an expansion of secure, accessible absentee drop boxes to allow for increased participation of voters with disabilities and other Wisconsin voters. You see how limited ballot drop boxes could create a barrier for some voters in Wisconsin?
Well, if in fact they're right about that, and again, I express no opinion on that, then the remedy is to go to the legislature. And, you know, they say that they want secure and accessible drop boxes. One of the things that would happen if we followed the law and, you know, we said, look, we're not going to have these unless the legislature specifically provides for them, is that, you know, the legislature would at that point be able to address what needs to be done in order to make those drop boxes secure and accessible. And there have been proposals that would do just that. But right now what we have is sort of the wild, wild west, where clerks do it or they don't do it. Some of them have drop boxes, some of them don't. Some of them may have provisions for their security, some of them may not. And the problem is that this is what happens. We don't follow the law as it is written, and we kind of make things up as we go along. And so all we're asking is that the law as it's written be followed.
Well, Rick, the states...
That certainly is an avenue that's open to them.
Well, as you bring that up, the state Senate recently passed a bill that appears to be in sync with your legal challenge. This bill allows municipalities to have drive-up ballot drop boxes if they are secured and surveilled. If it becomes law, municipalities with a population of at least 70,000 would be allowed up to 3 additional drop boxes on municipal property, but not in public parks like the Democracy in the Park from Madison. What's your take on this bill, Rick?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, that's the way that we should do this. Now, they've decided that they don't want to have an event like Democracy in the Park, and I can understand why they might not want to have that. Democracy in the Park, this was an event where you brought a lot of people, you deputized a bunch of people who may be partisan to collect ballots. It's very, very difficult to supervise a process that involves that many people in that many locations. And I think it's not unreasonable for the legislature to decide, look, that's not the way that we're going to do this. We're going to do this in a way which has, you know, more appropriate safeguards. But absolutely. I mean, I have no problem with the legislature passing that type of law. But the thing is, and I know that this may sound technical and formal, but when it comes to elections, where, you know, people feel very, very strongly about the outcome. You know, every election cycle, you know, people are threatening to leave the country if the wrong person gets elected president. Now, they never do, but you know, this is just an indication of how strongly they feel about it. It's important that we have confidence in the outcome. And one of the ways in which we have confidence in the outcome is to have a set of rules, which are agreed upon beforehand, and we do, and then to follow those rules. That's how it ought to be done.
Rick, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Rick Essenberg, President and General Counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Up next news, then we hear an opponent's take on Enbridge Energy's Line 3 pipeline replacement project leading to Superior. Hundreds arrested during protests last month, more over the weekend. Do you support or oppose Line 3? You can join our conversation after the news, 1-800-642-1234, as we're joined by Paul Demain. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Last month, the Enbridge Energy Company received approval from the Minnesota courts to continue with its plan to complete the rebuild of their Line 3 oil pipeline, connecting the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, to the Enbridge Terminal in Superior. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. And we're talking about a proposal for 340 miles of new pipe that is already 60% complete, valued at $4 billion. But this new pipeline is taking a more circuitous path through Minnesota on its way to Superior, where more protesters were arrested over this past holiday weekend. Do you support the completion of Line 3? Would you rather speak out on behalf of the protesters? And if energy companies are using native lands or resources, what role should our native nations play in shaping our energy future? We'll take your calls at 1-800-642-1234, and you can email us ideas@WPR.org. We are up on the Twitter as well at WPR Mornings. Our guest is Paul Demain, Chair of Honor of the Earth's Board of Directors. The organization opposes Enbridge Energy's Line 3 pipeline placement. Paul's a member of the Oneida Nation. He lives in the Lac-Couturier Ojibwe Reservation near Hayward. And Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
I understand you were at the Welcome Center along the Mississippi, where, along with the protesters, where the construction is continuing for the Enbridge Line 3. Can you just give us some idea of what's going on there today, what you saw over the weekend, and what you expect to take place next?
Well, the Mississippi Water Protectors Welcome Center is one of two of the 8 or 9 camps and facilities, organizations that have hosting sites in northern Minnesota. So I spent most of my 4th of July weekend on the Shell River looking at that particular river and stopped at the Mississippi Water Protectors Welcome Center on the way back. You want to remember you have a 340-mile pipeline route, and you have several different types of camps there. Some of our resistance direct action camps, some are camps sponsored by tribal governments. Some of the camps, like the two that I help oversee, are overseen by Honor the Earth and environmental organizations, and we're host organizations. So what I saw was a lot of people getting educated about treaty rights and uses so that they can function as diplomats. And we had people from Wisconsin at the Shell River this weekend, where the activities were up and around Park Rapids in Hubbard County. There are 17 county jurisdictions, so things are a little bit different in each county, very much unlike the Dakota Access protest, where Enbridge had worked from two directions to the Missouri River, and there was one river crossing that they had to get across. They have to get across 22 major rivers, yet they have to get across a couple hundred wetlands with Army Corps permits for drilling. And so that's the hard haul of this pipeline. So when Enbridge says they're 60% done, they've done the easy drop of the lines and the excavation and so forth, but they got some heavy lifting to do to get the last components of this in. And since November 15th, approximately, when they were got their Minnesota permits and the last permits they needed, and there's a whole process that's appealable, the Public Utilities Commission, the Minnesota Department of Commerce, the Minnesota Department of Waste Discharge Control, and various other agencies, and then the Army Corps permit, which it was incompleted, which ends up being the problem. The Trump administration under the Army Corps of Engineers waives the environmental impact statement component of the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the federal authority. And so outside of all the other arguments, the global warming, the 115 degrees in Seattle with roadways buckling and bridges melting and tar melting and other things, you ask the question at that point, if Seattle is crumbling and has millions of dollars of damage from a 115 degree heat wave in June, what is it going to be like in July and August? And what is it going to be like next year when it hits 122 or 124? So I don't think we have to discuss the impacts of global warming. We see them around them on a daily, around ourselves on a daily basis. We look at the destruction of what's occurred in Calgary, Alberta, to the Chippewa Cree lands. On that end, as those dirty tar sands come through the United States, and we look at the damage at Kalamazoo or in Rusk County, Wisconsin, Wisconsin's largest Enbridge oil spill that most people don't know about because it was in the middle of the woods in the middle of nowhere. And we look at the other 300 leaks along those routes or the 33 on line 3 in Minnesota that was in and around Indian reservations. And the Indian reservations, the Ojibwe Nation, 1863 at Red Lake, 1855 with Mille Lacs, Leech Lake, Gull Lake, East Lake, and White Earth, who didn't want the line on their reservation anymore, despite the fact that it brings lots of economic income and benefits from a foreign corporation in Canada when they settle. You know, people have had enough and are concerned about this from the Mackinac to Bad River to Kalamazoo to Alberta. So that's a little bit about, you know, the hub of everything. And within Minnesota, there are people that feel there were deficiencies in the consultation process.
But Paul, give me a second, if I can, to just sort of provide the perspective, according to Enbridge Energy, that they have an old line three, that the line three, as it was originally installed, was corrosive, and that corrosion could cause some concerns for other oil leaks, and therefore line three needs to be replaced. Now, the path that it is taking through Minnesota is a new path that seems to go around or bypass an isthmus between two lakes, which may provide for a little more, I don't know, environmental protection for a pipeline. So the opposition for Enbridge Line 3, how do you put that in the context from the energy company's call for safety and protection to create a new one to replace the old Line 3?
Well, the line three, the lines are corrosive because of the dirty tar sands. You know, they pull it out of the earth and it costs $90 a barrel, and nobody in the United States, which is domestically independent of Canadian oil and everybody else's, wants to pay $90 for a barrel when you can frack it in Montana at 70 or pump it out of Oklahoma at 55. So we're basically a bypass route. It's not just avoiding two lakes. It's 340 miles long. It's not on any of the current Indian reservations that have easements because people are tired of having to get bottled water delivered to their home. They're tired of emergency warnings. They're tired of evacuations. They're tired of thinking about what is going to happen to their wild rice and everything else. Enbridge's Line 3 had the largest oil spill in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, about 20 years back when it went under another name and changed their name so you wouldn't know it was the same company. But that spill up there led to a reduction in the pressure in Line 3. And Line 3 is the safest line that Enbridge now operates. Even though in the system, I mean, people in Jefferson County understand very well that when Enbridge had a leak there and didn't report for 15 months, and they reported as 1.5 gallon leak, and now it's at 1,600, and they're restudying and asked the question, how can you have a leak of a couple thousand gallons of petroleum products and nothing goes off? Well, on the Enbridge grid, Enbridge can lose 91,000 gallons of product a day. It's called shrinkage in the maple syrup industry, and no alarms will go off. That's a daily basis figure on their entire grid that's going into the system, in addition to the spills. So when you say they want to reroute an unsafe pipeline. Yes, it had the biggest leak, but Enbridge is running their pipes at 115-125%. They've been pumping up the pump sites all the way through Wisconsin last year to jam more of this tar sands because it comes out as peanut butter. They got to send dilutant north in order to thin it out. When it leaks, it drops to the bottom of lakes like it did in rivers, like it did in the Kalamazoo, and it cost them a couple extra billion dollars. Now, Enbridge added $1.1 billion to the project a couple weeks ago because of delays. I wish I had $1.1 billion to take out of my back pocket like chump change and put into the opposition to this, because if regulators in the system work, they would have heard the 78,000 people that oppose this pipeline in Minnesota compared to the 17,000 people who said they wanted it, that Enbridge organized and gave t-shirts and bought into. This company has operated in the Great Lakes for 50 years, and in the last 2 years, they have thrown money everywhere at every community. There was a dispute in Hayward over the Birkenbeiner donation because they didn't want it anymore. Butch Johnson of Timber Company pulled his money because he's a Republican donor that likes pipelines. He's got all the Enbridge routes on his property. So they've caused a lot of controversy impacting tribal politics, trying to get tribal chairmen unelected and thrown out of office. This is a foreign corporation that has bought water policy in the Great Lakes, and you need to look at all the components to understand why it's just not a replacement pipe. They could run line 3 at 60%. What we've learned is if they run their pipes at the capacity they were built for, they run safer. But when you keep trying to jam more product into it so you can make more, you know, nobody in Calgary, Alberta, Canada needs to make any more money. They've been billionaires.
Would you rather, Paul, would you rather see this tar sands being shipped by trucks or trains if there could be no line 3 altogether for Enbridge Energy?
We don't need the dirtiest product on earth. We don't need tar sands. Nobody in the United States is reliant on tar sands. So I don't want it shipped at all. I don't want Canadian oil. I don't want tar sands oil that Canadian citizens don't want in their country because they're afraid it will wreck their water systems. Their laws are a lot more tighter. You can come to the United States and get a permit just by showering politicians, business people, unions with money, which they've done. They have spent billions of dollars buying and hijacking United States Great Lakes water policies, and we're going to oppose that.
We're talking about Enbridge Energy's Line 3 replacement pipeline leading to Superior. Our guest is an opponent, Paul DeMaine. He's the chair of Honor the Earth's Board of Directors. And we have the regulators who have given approval now and have acknowledged that there is credible arguments on both sides as to whether or not this Line 3 rebuild is, or if this Line 3 is necessary for energy purposes. But what about the economy, Paul?
There's jobs. There's thousands of jobs in the green energy economy if we get there. There are thousands of communities, including Palisade, Minnesota, just south of the Line 3, that don't have clean running water. If people want to build pipelines, go to Flint, Michigan, and redo the water system there so people have clean water. It's about clean water. You know, yesterday, Winona LaDuc from Honor the Earth filed a legal brief or a lawsuit in federal court somewhere, I don't know where it is, saying that the Shell River has a right to live, that a foreign corporation doesn't have a right. You know, for example, let's look at their engineering. They applied for 520 million gallons of water use, got their permit in November. 2 weeks ago, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources granted them a change in their permit from 520 million gallons to 485 billion gallons in the middle of a drought,
Paul,
because they made a mistake.
Yeah, stop right there, because it's an amazing story and it goes to the heart of where Enbridge Line 3 may be heading, to Superior. Our guest is Paul DeMaine, and our conversation continues along with you at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Do you support or oppose the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline replacement project? Paul DeMaine continues with us. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. More arrests reported over the weekend along the route of Enbridge Energy's construction of Line 3. There have been hundreds of arrests of protesters over this past month. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and those opposed to Enbridge's new route for their Line 3 have vowed to continue to fight. Russ Bennett from Madison was one of those protesting in Minnesota last month.
I believe in the science of climate change. I believe that we are largely responsible for it, and we are largely the ones that are needing to change the way we live.
Bennett told WPR he wants President Biden to shut down the pipeline. Do you think the president should get involved like he did with the Keystone XL pipeline? Also, if you are a member of our native tribes, I really want to know how you see sovereignty in these United States. 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul DeMaine is chair of the Honor the Earth Board of Directors and a member of the Oneida Nation. He's also the former editor of Indian Country News and has been along the construction route over this past week and dating back for a while now. We left you, Paul, with a story about Enbridge earlier this month being granted a modification to their water permit with an error that they were granted originally 520 million gallons. That has been expanded to 485,000 billion. Can you explain what this water is doing, what Enbridge is trying to do with this permit?
Yeah, you said thousand and billion, but it was 425 million gallons to 485 billion gallons. And they said it was an engineering error that they occurred. They paid $150 fine, and the Minnesota DNR pretty much notified the tribes about the results. So that's how, in this process, there's a thing called the environmental impact statement, which the Trump administration waived because they wanted to get jobs. And I understand that. I have cousins and relatives working for Enbridge. I have law enforcement relatives that are on that side of the aisle. They need jobs and so forth. We're not trying to deprive people of jobs. We're trying to create new energy jobs. That's but the responsibility of our organization. That's our original intent. The thing is that when we look at what the foreign corporation is doing and how it's influenced the politics of the Great Lakes area, it's an issue where if you've got lots of money, you're up against Goliath, and we are David's trying to fight the big, the black snake is what they call it. But let's look at this. You don't have meaningful consultation with tribal nations under their contracts and their reservation of usufructuary rights by having a coffee in downtown Hayward or someplace else and say, let's talk about the line. And they don't consult at the county level or the township level. And generally, they don't participate in the state level. Their level was at the Army Corps of Engineers with an environmental impact statement was waived in order to get the project in for jobs by the Trump administration. And it's a Trump administration problem that's helped create the situation.
Do you think President Biden should get involved, Paul?
Biden should get involved. Yes.
All right. I also want to get a call in here if we could quickly. Jeff in Delafield, you are on the morning show with Paul DeMaine.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you. For the most part, I agree with the comments about climate change and the potential for pollution of the pipeline. But I like what you said about possibly running it at 60% and making the existing pipeline safe. But I question the desire for putting wind turbines and solar panels all over the landscape, aside from the potential for a leak, how is that any less obtrusive than an oil pipeline? And I guess I wonder, why aren't we emphasizing more native landscapes and trees and grasslands and converting some of our farmland to uses that will absorb carbon as opposed to more and more wind turbines and solar panels, which to me are not that attractive. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Paul?
Well, first of all, the United States barely uses any of these products, and nobody's trying to deprive anyone from frying their eggs on the UP by changing a foreign oil, a foreign company, requiring them to take their product through their own country. Again, why would you want to buy a barrel of oil at $90, which is dirty, which is explosive, which is one of the most dirtiest products that comes out of the earth? And it's not like we're trying to shut down the pipelines. We like to eliminate the dirtiest of the product to get it out of the system, because global warming is an issue. The filth of the product, the fact that we don't use a lot of those products in the United States, were mainly a flow through. Why do we want to pay $90 a barrel when we frack it at 70 and pump it out of Oklahoma at 55? this is basically a shortcut through the United States for a lot of their products to go to Canada and Sarnia on line 5 and down to other refineries in Texas so they can be exported to poor countries, use monetary fund monies to get it. So, you know, there are so many different ways we can get our energy, but we have to reduce our carbon footprint. Each one of us has to do things that reduce our carbon footprint and use less energy while we convert. And it's possible. It's the technology is already there in hundreds of different ways. And if we put the kind of money into research for new energy, we wouldn't be trying to, you know, people are trying to drive a Model A around and they take their 8-track to put it into a modern new car and it doesn't exist. Those things, it's old technology, it's old economy.
Paul DeMain, let me reintroduce you here, chair of the Honor the Earth's board of directors and a member of the Oneida Nation. He is the former editor of Indian Country News. We've been talking about the protests over Line 3 that is making its way to Superior through Minnesota through a more circuitous route. But Paul, you also mentioned Line 5, Enbridge connection to Line 5 and the lawsuits that are entailed at the Bad River in Wisconsin and Mackinac Straits in Michigan. Can you tell us what's happening there?
Everybody along this route, many, many people, not everybody, there's a lot of people that buy into it because they've bought every Indian that's purchasable. They've done contracts. They've showered our communities with money. Everybody can tell you about the ads and everything else. But I want to get something now back to something else real quickly. If there's meaningful consultation with Indian tribes, this might not have happened either. They had a right to be heard at the Army Corps of Engineers to protect the public lands that they take resources out. You're in a drought in northern Minnesota. The rice beds are dying because of lack of water, and a foreign corporation buys its way into 480 billion gallons of water at a time when the Shell River is dying. The clams are trying to get out of their beds and go to the middle of the lake. You got algae blooms in June when they usually come in late August. There are inherent rights that living things have. And when you put that up against the corporations in the United States that are seen and have individual rights, the rights of the Shell River and other rivers in Minnesota have a right to live and provide the food and economic activity that Indian tribes have reserved. That meaningful consultation is not taking place. This is like a declaration of war. Screw off tribes. A foreign corporation with money can buy their policy, and tribes and wild rice and rivers have no rights when it comes to a $1 billion foreign corporation.
Paul DeMain, for those who are listening to you this morning and are nodding along in consent or agreement, what can they do?
Stopline3.org. Is the main site to go to for information. There are churches, there are environmental organizations in our community from Milwaukee, all over the state, all over the world, all over the United States. The globe is watching how the U.S. treats its indigenous people. The world is looking what it's going to do to be a leader, getting into renewable energy and getting rid of the old technology that's the Model A and the dirtiest of the dirtiest of the dirtiest oil in the world. Let's get rid of that first. Then we can work on fracking and other things and make the conversion. There are plenty of good paying jobs in the renewable energy sector. Let's get on with the new technology and try to save our earth, because at 115 degrees, when it goes to 125, Seattle, Washington isn't going to survive. They didn't survive the last heat wave.
Paul,
we've got to put an end to it.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul DeMain, chair of the Honor the Earth Board of Directors and a member of the United Nation. Just ahead, we discuss Memento Mori. Do you know what that is? We'll explain. I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.